On Tuesday, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro announced the release of a scathing 880-page report detailing decades of child sex abuse at the hands of the Catholic Church in six of the state's eight dioceses.
The largest, most comprehensive report into child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church ever produced in the United States was released.
In painful detail, the report includes the accounts of more than 1,000 child victims.
For the first time, we can begin to understand the systematic cover-up by church leaders that followed.
Several of the survivors who testified spoke to CBS News leading up to the report's release.
It's a voice for the voiceless.
The word abuse gets thrown around. We're talking rapes.
My abuser, when he took his collar off, he told me that he could do whatever he wanted to do.
I would say to him, "Why did you do this to me?" And I believe his answer is going to be, "Because I can, because I could."
This report is me getting my life back, saying, these are the evil bastards that stole my life.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Today, a look inside this report and how the Catholic Church shielded hundreds of predator priests at the expense of children and families. In just a minute, we'll hear from Lawrence Thomas Persico, the bishop of the Diocese of Erie, Pennsylvania, which is one of the six dioceses investigated and found culpable of abuse. But first, we turn to Kevin McCory, reporter and editor at WHYY in Philadelphia and for Keystone Crossroads, a collaboration of public media across the state. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why is this report coming out now, and who was behind the report?
Well, Attorney General Josh Shapiro got things moving a couple years ago when he decided to convene a grand jury to investigate what we had already known had happened in Philadelphia and another diocese in Pennsylvania, the Altoona-Johnstown Diocese. And this was basically a decision by the Attorney General's office to say we have to investigate the entire state.
We've heard from some of the victims earlier in the piece who spoke to CBS News, but I'm wondering if you could walk us through what we know from the report about the specifics of the sexual abuse that was going on in this in these six dioceses.
Well, the story is not new, right? The pattern here we have seen in Boston, we've seen in Philadelphia, we've seen in many other places, but the specifics are always gruesome and horrid. You have an example of a priest in the Diocese of Harrisburg who allegedly abused five sisters in a single family. Other stories where priests are impregnating people, forcing them to get abortions. Others where you have priests forcing boys to strip naked, take photos of them, distribute those photos on church grounds, you know, as child pornography. Others where you have priests having seven-year-old boys fillet them. It's horrid, horrid stuff here.
Kevin, what are the, we've heard a lot about the statute of limitations and many of these priests being dead, so it's hard to bring charges at this point. But do victims have any recourse whatsoever?
Most of them, no. In Pennsylvania, the laws were amended, but still the scope of this report, it takes place over the course of many decades. And most of the victims in it, the bulk of them, the real majority of them, have no legal, criminal, or civil recourse at this point. So, you know, some of the recommendations that the grand jury made was, A, moving forward, let's just eliminate the statute of limitations on child sexual abuse and make it akin to murder, where there's just no statute of limitations.
How likely is that to happen, though?
So that one is probably more likely to happen because it would pertain to future victims, right? The harder thing would be to say, and this is also what the grand jury recommended in this report, is to say, if you want to file a civil case retroactively, we're going to give you a 2-year window. No matter when your abuse happened, you can essentially sue the church and seek financial damages. You know, the church has long fought that. They say it would bankrupt them currently for sins of the past. Victims say, you know, that's what they need to feel like they have their day in court truly and can find justice.
Well, we'll be hearing from a bishop from the church shortly. Kevin McCory is an editor for Keystone Crossroads, a collaboration between WHYY in Philadelphia and other public media across the state. Kevin, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Gail. I'm from Los Angeles, California.
I'm Joe Alvarez. I'm calling from Shirley, Massachusetts.
This is Tom from Duncanville, Texas.
Dennis Lynch. I'm calling from Bristol, Rhode Island.
My view of the Roman Catholic Church has not changed.
I was born into a Catholic family, went to Catholic grammar school, high school, and Catholic college. I am no longer in the Catholic faith.
I removed my family from the Roman Catholic Church when my son was born about 26 years ago.
I was very disgusted by the fact that the Catholics were having so much children abuse and covering it up.
I did not want to raise children in an old boys network type of church.
I consider it to be my faith, and I haven't left just because of a few bad actors, I guess, as well as the bad leaders who made terrible decisions along the way.
Priests are fallible, but the church's teachings are not.
I think that the requirement for priestly celibacy traps men in a lifestyle that's far different from that which most people live. And most of all, it serves to affirm the church's age-old male hierarchy, which is part of the problem.
And now we turn to the Catholic Church. Bishop Lawrence Persico is head of the Diocese of Erie, one of the six parishes investigated in this report. And he was the only bishop who agreed to testify during the extensive investigation. Bishop Persico, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So your reaction to this report, what was it?
It was very sobering, disgusting, and shameful.
Bishop, the Catholic Church is certainly not the only place where abuse, child abuse, does happen, but it has happened within the church systemically and repeatedly for decades, and this has affected thousands of children. Why does this keep happening, Bishop? Is it an indication that it's time to allow changes to the priesthood? Things like allowing women to become priests, allowing priests to marry, perhaps rethinking the celibacy rules around the priesthood.
Well, I don't know if that's going to curb child abuse, because I think, as indicated with our list, we have men and women who are credibly accused of child abuse. And some of them were married. So I think it's a societal issue. The important thing is that we become transparent about these things and not try to cover them up. Not only is this an issue in the Catholic Church, as apparent from the grand jury report, but it's a problem in schools, universities. It's a problem in the medical profession, as we recently learned, among coaches. So I think it's a societal issue, and I don't know if changes in the priesthood is going to make that kind of difference. I think, and you had mentioned celibacy, I don't think this has anything to do with celibacy, especially when you have married people who commit abuse. It happens in families. So I see this more as a societal issue that needs to be addressed.
I agree that it's a societal issue, Bishop, to a certain extent. However, this is happening under the auspices of God, of faith. And this is something that has been a repeated problem within the Catholic Church for as far back as I can remember. To suggest that it's purely societal, I do think is almost a lack of reflection on the Church itself.
Well, if you get to the root of it, I think part of the problem is that for so long it's been kept quiet, and it's devastating when, it's especially someone that you're supposed to trust, have confidence in, a leader of the community and a leader of the faith community. So that makes it especially horrendous.
We, on The Takeaway, have regularly reached out to our listeners and asked them for their reactions to the news. And we've gotten some callers, who said that they continue to separate the church as an entity from their personal faith because of a lot of the things that have happened. One caller said, you know, priests are fallible, the church is not. Others have left the church, and I'm going to read you some numbers here. We have the percentage of U.S. Catholics across the United States has dropped. This is numbers from Pew, 3.1% from 2007 to 2014. The U.S. Catholic Church attendance numbers have also gone down significantly, from 75% in 1955 to only 39% of U.S. Catholics actually attending church. So there is something happening here, Bishop. What's your reaction to those numbers?
Well, I really think that this is, you know, part of the reaction against the institution, because we have let people down. And so people are angry and they're walking away. And I can understand that it makes it very difficult to have faith when people who are there, who are supposed to lead you and be examples, have betrayed you.
What are some, you mentioned a couple of things that your parish is doing. Can you give us a little more detail on that?
Well, we've done three things. One, we put out a list of credibly accused abusers, and we've enhanced our policy for the protection of children so that it's more in line with civil law. Third, we automatically turn things over to the civil authorities instead of trying to investigate them on our own. We also have independent investigators who assist us, and we've enhanced our office for the protection of children. And what the office does, as you know, some people may get clearances and background checks, past background checks, but we keep a list of names that we would not allow to work in our diocese, even though they could receive background checks and clearances, because of, you know, they broke our policy or some other reason. But before anyone is hired, whether it's in a school, an agency, or employment at the diocese, they have to be cleared through that office first.
Bishop, what would you tell people who are hearing this news today, whether they're lapsed Catholics, practicing Catholics, or not even Catholic, who want to believe that this is something, a place that they could potentially put their faith in, and they're just seeing this become more and more difficult as more of these cases come out? I mean, we're talking about thousands of children. What do you say to those folks?
Well, the first thing would obviously be that, you know, I'm sorry that this has happened, and I apologize to victims. But also, don't give up your faith in God. These are people, human beings, who are sinners like all of us. And we should not walk away from God in this and totally give up one's faith.
Bishop Lawrence Persico is head of the Diocese of Erie. Thank you so much for being with us, Bishop.
You're welcome.
In the Vermont gubernatorial primary on Tuesday, Christine Hallquist made history. The former energy executive defeated four Democratic primary opponents to become the first transgender nominee for governor in the nation. But can she unseat sitting Republican Governor Phil Scott in November and become the nation's first transgender governor? Christine Hallquist is with us now. Thanks for being here, Christine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've never had a seat in public office before. I mean, you had previously been the CEO of Vermont Electric Cooperative. What was the thing that made you want to shift from that to running for governor?
Well, let's put it this way. It wasn't something I really wanted to do. I think it's a sign of where we are in this country. You know, I look at what happened in 2016, and of course, I went into political depression. And in 2017, I was in denial. But it turns out our governor was using the same tactics that the national GOP is using. He just happens to be a really nice guy.
Well, in November, you're going to be facing the Republican incumbent, Governor Phil Scott. And you said that you voted for him in the 2016 governor's race. Is that correct?
Yes, and I'm doing my penance now, aren't I?
Well, given that you've supported him in the past, and he is the incumbent, which gives him a natural edge, how do you expect to win over in November?
Well, you know, our governor went from the third most popular to 13th most unpopular in the past couple months. And it's because all of us are waking up to the fact that this is not the person we thought we knew. He's basically been focusing on division, and he's been attacking our public education system. You know, the other thing he talks about is no new taxes. Of course, nobody wants to raise taxes, but he has no long-range plan for how to get more food on the table. You know, we're going to end up fighting with scraps forever if we don't have a long-range vision. And I think the leader's job is to look out 20 years and say, what's Vermont going to look like 20 years from now?
Well, let's talk about it, Christine. What is your progressive platform for your campaign? What are some of the key elements that you see helping Vermonters over the next 15, 20 years?
Well, you know, first of all, what we're seeing in Vermont is what we're seeing all across rural America today, because I've served on the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association organization. So what we're seeing today is really reminiscent of what we saw in the 30s. In the 1930s, the cities had electricity and rural America did not. And at that time, we were seeing increasing flights to the city, increasing poverty, and an aging demographic. We're seeing the exact same thing today. And it's because of the digital divide. So we ran wires to every home and business. We're going to run fiber optic every home and business.
And some of the other things your platform includes is you want a $15 minimum wage, universal health care. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I would say I'd like us to move back to a living wage. You know, there's been a systematic attack on the working class since the early 80s. And now we're in this place where, you know, the people are homeless, that the cost of housing is too high in terms of our income. I find it strange we call that progressive. You know, providing health care for all and ensuring people have a living wage, I think that's what a civilized society should be doing. I don't care what your political stripe is. I think that's just decency.
And of course, you are the first transgender woman to be nominated by a major party for governor, not just in the state of Vermont, but across the country. What do you think this nomination means for our country's transgender community?
I think it means it's even beyond our transgender community. I like to look at America and say we've always been aspirational. Aspirational means we've been widening our moral compass. And this is one step further to America widening its moral compass and being welcoming and more loving of others. Certainly here in Vermont, Vermont's always been welcoming. So it hasn't been an issue here in Vermont. Vermonters have been saying, okay, Christine, what are you going to do for us?
Christine Hallquist is the Democratic nominee in the Vermont governor's race. Christine, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
On Tuesday, Nebraska executed 60-year-old convicted murderer Carrie Dean Moore. And with that, it became a day of firsts. It was the first execution in 21 years in Nebraska and the first execution by lethal injection there. It was also the first time in our country's history that a state used the synthetic opioid fentanyl to put someone to death. Fentanyl was responsible for the overdose deaths of tens of thousands of Americans last year, and has become a significant driver of the opioid crisis. But using it to kill someone on death row, that is a first. Maurice Shuma is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Maurice, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So much to unpack here, but let's start with the fentanyl. Why use fentanyl in this case?
So for the past 5 to 10 years, states around the country that have the death penalty and want to carry out executions have struggled to find drugs. Part of that is drug companies saying that they don't want their products used in these executions. Part of it is activists, both in Europe and the U.S., kind of putting public pressure on those companies. And the result is that they've sort of had to go far afield and look for new combinations of drugs, new sources of drugs. And there's just a constant sort of game of hopscotch that happens. And fentanyl became the latest drug that was used. And of course, it had the reputation as being sort of a well-known drug that has caused all these overdose deaths, where, of course, you know, many of the drugs that case using these executions are pretty much obscure unless you're an anesthesiologist.
Now, does this execution on Tuesday mean that we're going to see more states turning to fentanyl?
It's possible. Nevada has already considered using fentanyl and plans to use it and was actually scheduled to use it first before that execution got stayed. And I do think that states will see what happened in Nebraska and say, well, this is a new combination that is potentially, you know, very useful and gets around some of the problems we've been having getting drugs. But that said, it's not clear where the fentanyl in this case came from. And a separate drug company protested the use of its drugs in court, even, you know, before the execution happened. A judge ruled for the state in that case, but you can imagine sort of a series of new challenges by drug companies and kind of ongoing litigation that makes it sort of questionable whether fentanyl will really become sort of the main way that states execute now.
Well, and we should remind our listeners that here on The Takeaway a couple months ago, we covered a Nevada case which was set to be the first use of fentanyl, and then the case was halted. Can you tell us why? What happened there?
Sure. It was a prisoner named Scott Dozier. Both he and Kerry Dean Moore, the man who was executed in Nebraska yesterday, are what is called in the legal world volunteers. They gave up their appeals and said, I don't want to fight this anymore. I want to be executed. In both Nebraska and Nevada, that set off a sort of frantic scramble to get the execution chamber running again to find these drugs. And in Nevada, everything was set up for Scott Dozier to be executed not long ago. And then a couple of drug companies went into court and said, we think that our drugs were obtained illegally by the state, and we think that the execution should be halted while we contest in court, you know, the way in which these drugs were acquired because we opposed their use in this execution.
And what about in the broader context of the opioid crisis we're facing in the United States, as we mentioned in the introduction here? Do you think there's any risk in using the drug for this purpose when it's already dangerously prevalent on the streets, or are those two completely different things?
Well, certainly I think that state prison agencies that are carrying out these executions would try to say that they're completely separate. You know, fentanyl, although it has caused many overdose deaths, that isn't the same as, you know, it has clinical therapeutic uses. And when you inject it into somebody for an execution, it's sort of not particularly well understood or known what happens. Yesterday was the first time, of course, and there are media accounts. I don't think there's been any sort of autopsy released yet. So we really don't know what it does to you, especially in conjunction with these other drugs. And similarly, you know, if someone's out on the street and uses fentanyl, it might be in combination with other drugs. So every situation is kind of unique. But the question of whether it's dangerous, I mean, an execution is about ending a life. And those people who support the death penalty often point to the sort of egregious nature of the original murder and say, well, this is going to be better than that. So it doesn't matter if there's some pain. There's sort of always a legal debate about cruel and unusual punishment with these drugs. And we're going to kind of see that continuing. I could imagine the opioid crisis and the ways in which overdoses play out kind of informing that debate.
The state of Nebraska executed a man using a cocktail that included fentanyl on Tuesday, and we're unpacking that execution with Maurice Shema of the Marshall Project. Maurice, let's look at Nebraska itself. The state has had a pretty interesting and or challenging relationship with the death penalty. Give us a sense of what's been happening there.
So that's true. Nebraska in the last 40, 50 years has carried out very few executions. The last one was in 1997. It's one of a number of states that kind of have the death penalty in theory, but not in practice. You know, they keep it on the books, but they very rarely carry it out. It's not Texas or Florida or Georgia. The legislature there, which is like the state as a whole, fairly conservative, voted to abolish the death penalty several years ago, and it was considered a big kind of bellwether in terms of conservatives rethinking whether the death penalty was a good idea. So some of them said that it's too expensive. Some of them said that it robs people of the chance at redemption. There was kind of a Christian influence there. There was a libertarian influence saying that it was kind of government overreach. So the legislature votes to abolish the death penalty. The governor, Pete Ricketts, who is a supporter of the death penalty, vetoes that legislation. The legislature overrides the veto, and then Ricketts, along with a big kind of grassroots swell of Nebraskans, put the question of the death penalty on to a public vote and voted back in.
Which Ricketts, I want to talk about Ricketts here because he, number one, he's Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And Pope Francis has condemned the death penalty, let's be very clear. And then Ricketts is also pro-death penalty. And he pushed this agenda forward with his own money, is that right? Right,
that's right.
How do you figure that out? You could be Catholic and pro-death penalty.
You can. I mean, every Catholic politician, going back to Kennedy, has had to kind of navigate the relationship between their faith and their public views and the sort of what they view to be the will of the people. I think Ricketts, on the one hand, could be kind of politically grandstanding. On the other, might really think that the number of Nebraskans who want the death penalty is a lot. It's over 50%. And there's sort of a political quandary for him, I think, going forward, now that the Pope's decision is sort of putting pressure on Catholic politicians to define their views and really articulate why it is that they continue to support the death penalty.
Maurice Shema, staff writer at the Marshall Project. Maurice, thank you for everything, as always.
Thank you.
Que el odio se muera de hambre, porque nadie le da de comer. Vamos juntos a romper muros, barreras y alambres.
Ileana Cabra, better known as Ile, is a former member of the Puerto Rican band Calle 13. For years, the band was known for its social commentary. But now Ile is out on her own, and she has a lot to say about the state of politics and her island.
It was like a lot at the same time, and I was angry, and I started like writing for myself, and then it started like transforming into a song.
Odio is the name of that new song out today.
Odio means hate, so I started thinking about hatred and how we suddenly become unconscious about it, and then we react maybe in ways that we shouldn't react.
The song's music video is as politically charged as the lyrics. It's a reenactment of the Cerro Maravilla massacre. In 1978, two young pro-independence activists were murdered in an ambush by the police, and many Puerto Ricans saw the government's response to the killings as a cover-up. Ile says the fight for identity then is not so different from what we are seeing today.
These two young guys, they were pro-independence. And in that time specifically, things were very intense in terms of politics and the statehood. These were the 70s. There was like a revolutionary moment. It was one of the biggest cases in Puerto Rico because they had three investigations afterwards where they were all covered up by the United States government as well as Puerto Rico. And then in 1983, the investigation opens up again and it got televised in Puerto Rico. That's why it became so famous. And they could arrest a lot of the responsible ones. But the governor of Puerto Rico by that time was Carlos Romero Barceló. And he's still free, as well as Pérez Casillas and Rivera Casiano, who was his right hand. And they got rid of a lot of information, a lot of evidence. And also they killed the undercover agent. Well, they have different stories, but for me, that makes sense. He had a lot of information and he was young, so they got rid of him. And it sounds so ugly. And I wrote this song and I know it had like a lot of ways that I can go. But it was important for us that Puerto Ricans feel identified with a story that we expressed through this video. And for me, that's the main part. I don't want Puerto Ricans to feel separated from what goes on in the rest of the world, but feel identified and could empathize with what happens around us.
One of the things that strikes me, and maybe you're seeing this, is as we move into the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria, is that there seems to be a resurgence or an awakening of Puerto Ricans on the mainland and on the island about their history, about who they are, about this political history that you're talking about that goes further than the 70s, that goes as far back as, you know, the early 1900s in terms of Puerto Rico trying to get its independence. Do you see that? Are you seeing more Puerto Ricanos who are just awake and responsive and interested in learning who they are and what their history really is?
Well, after the hurricane, a lot of people realized that the country was not okay, but it was not because of the hurricane. Like it has always been like that. And they still are hoping that the states are going to help us. But unconsciously, we reacted and we started helping each other. So that's why it's like you say, well, this is what is supposed to happen. We're supposed to help each other. It's natural. It's like a human natural reaction when everyone needs from each other. You just help each other. And after the hurricane, there was a lot of awakening. I mean, people just reacted. The schools were flooded, so the parents just went there and started cleaning and helping each other. In all the things that were happening at that time, that was like the most beautiful thing. And that gave me hope. And I know that because of that, a little more people are more conscious about what's going on. But still, if the government is working ways to make us believe that we're comfortable in a way, well, people start to believe it. And what frustrates me the most, I think, is that part, that we as Puerto Ricans believe that we are less, believe that we are incapable, and believe that we should be dependent of someone that is superior. And I don't believe that at all. I think we're totally capable of working on our own and making our country better.
And then when you're saying our country, you mean Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
I just want to be clear. You're not talking about the United States.
No, I want Puerto Rico to be an independent country. I don't want it to be part of the United States. I don't have anything against it at all. And I love that Puerto Ricans are living in different countries. But I want my country to be free. And I think we need that. We need to acknowledge that we could do it by ourselves. I mean, we have been humiliated by so many years, and it's ugly, and it's ugly to see that we betray ourselves.
After something like Maria, right, and we know that this was traumatic, and it's still, for many people, is still traumatic, what happens to you as an artist? What happens to your music after something like Maria?
I never expect anything. In Puerto Rico, music and art, it's, I think, one of the hardest careers you can get. So I'm used to it. I don't expect anything at all. And I know that I should travel. I should do my best to travel to at least talk about what's going on in Puerto Rico. So maybe people go there at least and experience for themselves, because Puerto Rico is actually a paradise. It's beautiful. And it's a great way of living. I when I talk to people about Puerto Rico, it's people are so warm, and they just challenge their emotions through music and through dancing and through talking with each other. So it's a nice way of living, but at the same time, we're being so aplastados.
Knocked down, pressed down, yeah. Pushed down.
Yeah, and it feels horrible.
That's, do you think there's more people who want to be independentistas or independent or who want independence for Puerto Rico than there were before the hurricane?
I think younger people, younger than me, I'm used to being the little one, so younger than me, I think they have another energy. And I'm liking that. I think that a lot of young people are more conscious. I think because now they don't have a lot of taboos that still my generation, but older generations than mine, had a lot of taboos that now younger generations, they just don't care about them. And I love that. And because of that, they're more straightforward. Like, they get to the point, like, well, yeah, if this is messed up and this is not working, then maybe this is the answer. So maybe I'm hopeful because of that, because I've been in touch with a lot of younger people and students, and I like their energy, and it makes me feel hopeful.
Leana Cabra, better known as Ile, is a Puerto Rican singer whose new song, Odio, is out now. Ile, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Soy la respuesta perdida, esa que siempre quisiste, todo lo que no pudiste. Soy tu razón obstruida, soy de tu pecho el vacío, el corazón carcomido, la inconsciencia en tu oído, el miedo que no ha dormido. Llevo el puñal en mis ojos, cuidado que no te mire.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Que nadie le da de comer.
juntos a romper muros, barreras y alambres. Que el odio se muera de hambre, porque nadie le da de comer. Vamos juntos a romper muros, barreras y alambres.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.